Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to the live broadcast of Capital Markets Today. CMT is where experts come to discuss capital markets, trading, real estate, and lending-related topics. You may participate in online discussions by joining the Capital Markets Today group on LinkedIn and on Twitter. To obtain more information on CMT's guests and their companies, go to capital-mt.com and click on the past show contact info link. Podcasts of this show and past shows are also available on the web at capital-mt.com. Now, your host of Capital Markets Today, Louis Amaya.
Welcome to Capital Markets Today. My name is Louis Amaya, host of CMT, and we are broadcasting live from San Diego, where it is sunny and warm today on Wednesday, February 27th. We have made several improvements to our website at capital-mt.com. We are offering free housing, mortgage, and default data on the web. The data is interactive and allows the user to export as well. In addition, our Listen on Demand feature is also improved, and as usual, we encourage you to take full advantage of CMT's functionality on the web. We have a loaded calendar in the coming weeks and invite you to tune in on March 6th. We have a panel of executives from Morningstar Credit Ratings. March 13th, Matt Martin, founder and CEO of Matt Martin Real Estate Management. March 20th, Matt Maurer, managing director of Mountain View Capital Holdings. And March 27th, Jim Park, founder and co-CEO of New Vista Asset Management and the Asian Real Estate Association of America. We have posted the dates, times, and topics on the web for your reference. Today, our guest is Tom Showalter, Chief Analytics Officer of Digital Risk. Tom is responsible for the data, analytics, and decisioning systems in use and under development. He has over 35 years of related experience at a number of major firms and nationally known organizations. In his career, Tom and his development team leveraged the extensive Digital Risk database to create unique and powerful analytics, with an extensive focus being placed upon applications that determine the most appropriate loss mitigating treatment for distressed mortgage loans. Tom's experience is complemented with a BA in psychology from Rutgers University, an MA in statistics and experimental psychology from the University of Virginia, and an MBA from Stanford University. We'll be right back with Tom Showalter. Welcome, Tom, and thanks for participating in the broadcast.
My pleasure, Louis. How are you today?
Very, very good. We're fortunate in San Diego. It's going to be hit about 80 degrees today. So I know in the Midwest and East they're experiencing a little bit colder weather right now. So feel fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get started, why don't you give me some background, a little bit more background, on your path to your position at Digital Risk and exactly what, you know, maybe dive a little bit deeper into what Digital Risk does.
Sure. I have been in the arena of the financial services industry and risk assessment since the early 80s. I had a position as head of marketing for TRW Credit Data. I also held a position as head of product and analytics for Loan Performance, which is a boutique mortgage analytics firm that got acquired by CoreLogic. I've also held a position as a vice president of advanced analytics for CoreLogic. And in the process, I've also been a chief risk officer for a subsidiary, an internet subsidiary sponsored by Wells Fargo. So I've had a wide exposure to a variety of different kinds of risk and risk estimation methodologies and risk-related data. And here at Digital Risk, one of the things that we've been focusing on is a topic that I'm going to introduce today later on, which is something called manufacturing risk. We have a huge database that estimates on previously non-performing loans. We've done a forensic audit, across over 750,000 loans. And the results of that audit have produced indications and estimates of the nature and kind of manufacturing defects that each of the loan contained that eventually led to their demise and the loss. So part of what we're going to talk about today are insights based upon the analysis and development of that database and how that plays into the risk formula and also the topic of the day, which is interest rates.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating. It's a really interesting and unique background. So you had mentioned interest rates. So we'll just dive into it. Where do you think rates are headed?
Good question. A bit of a crystal ball kind of question. There are a number of issues that could impact future interest rates. Before I get into the task of projecting future interest rates or what I think they're going to do, we need to discuss the relationship between interest rates and risk. This is going to be a little bit complicated, so let me give you a little metaphor here to help out. The task of interest rates and risk is much like crossing a pond, where we're beginning on one side where the risk resides, and we're going to the other side where the interest rates reside, and we're crossing the pond by finding stepping stones along the way, stepping from one stone to another. Journey will take a few minutes, and some of the stones are kind of slippery, so you'll hear me make note of that. The relationship between risk and interest rates is pretty simple. In the capital markets, the more risk a mortgage security or a loan represents, the higher the interest rate or the cost of capital that loan will require. And the level of risk an investor feels the loan represents exerts a fundamental influence on the coupon rate of the loan. The more risk, the higher the coupon rate, and the less risk, the lower the interest rate. Now then, let me dive into two drivers of the perception of risk. And they're fundamentally different, but they both come together in the end. Risk is divided into two major components. One's called the risk-free rate, or the drivers of the risk-free rate, and the other's the risk-driven rate. Now, the risk-free rate, you might say, okay, how does this relate to the overall interest rates? And we'll get to there in a second. The risk-free rate is a bit of an irony. It's really not risk-free. It represents the rate at which the U.S. will be charged for its debt. And this is considered risk-free because in nominal terms, the investor will always be paid back the amount he invested. So if he purchases a $10,000 bond, for example, he will receive $10,000 in return plus a designated interest at the appropriate time. Where the risk really lies in the risk-free domain is with inflation. If the investor is actually receiving dollars in the future that are worth far less than the dollars today, there's a discounting of the principal. It's just subtle. This risk is hard to estimate in advance, but it's real. The capital markets play a key role in estimating what the risk-free rate is or the time value of money. They basically take supply and demand factors and through that market-driven process come out with a yield on Treasury bills. For example, the 10-year T-bill, which is approximately going for 2%. Actually, this morning it was 1.86%. In the past week, it's been about 2% or 200 basis points. So that's the risk-free rate, and it's driven by the capital markets, and it has to do with the time value of money. Now, the risk-driven rate, this really has to do with risks that are more tied directly to the loan. That has to do with such risk as credit risk, which is the risk of loss and default, interest rate risk, and manufacturing risk. And we'll define all of these more in a moment. Now, before we get to the next set of questions, I need to talk a little bit about the structure of the mortgage industry with respect to risk-free rates and risk-driven rates. We're going to talk about three different kinds of loans. We're going to talk about conforming loans, non-conforming loans, and FHA loans. Now, conforming loans are guaranteed by the federal government, and they're issued by Fannie and Freddie, and they enjoy, in effect, a risk-free rate pricing scheme. Investors feel these loans have the same risk as T-bills. Most often, these loans are granted to the most creditworthy borrowers, those with a high FICO score and a very low loan-to-value. This in general, indicates very low levels of overall risk. Now, conforming loans derive their interest rate or their coupon rate off the 10-year T-bill rate, which, as mentioned, is approximately 200 basis points. The rate charged on government-guaranteed loans from Fannie and Freddie are approximately 150 basis points higher than the 10-year T-bill rate. This circumstance gives investors an arbitrage point. They can invest dollars in loans, Fannie securities, that earn considerably more than T-bills with the same level of overall risk. So, Conforming loans, risk-free rate pricing. Non-conforming loans, much different story. These loans are generated by private capital, and they are not government guaranteed. The interest rate or the coupon rate on these loans is a combination of the risk-free rate plus the risk-driven rate. Hence, the perception of risk-free and risk-driven issues are used to price these loans. Unlike conforming loans, the non-conforming loans have principal at risk. It is possible to buy $10,000 worth of non-conforming loan and only get $7,000 back. This is a big difference. Now then, in the past, these loans were securitized in the secondary market, and they often require a higher yield, meaning a higher interest rate. In the past, they have involved jumbo loans, subprime, and Alt-A. Unfortunately, as many have noted, non-conforming loans have incurred large losses over the last 5 years, especially in the meltdown. As a result, right now, the secondary market is reluctant to purchase non-conforming loans, also known as private label securities, because of the high levels of perceived risk and the inability to discern the appropriate price or the actual level of risk. Now then, there's a third type of loan I want to talk about. And these all come together in a structure that will help us understand future interest rate risks. There's the FHA loan, which is a hybrid. The FHA, like the conforming loan, is a government-guaranteed loan, so it enjoys the perception of low risk, and it's assigned a risk-free rate type of pricing. However, unlike conforming loans such as Fannie and Freddie, this loan has a much higher level of credit risk. They lend to much riskier borrowers. They employ a low down payment philosophy. They complement that with limited underwriting, and these have all posed credit risk issues in the past. So while risks are definitely higher in the FHA world, the government will pick up the tab and, in case of default and loss, you know, reimburse the investor for his principal. So you have three different kinds of loans, two of which enjoy risk-free pricing, which is the conforming loan and the FHA loan, and then you have the non-conforming loan, which enjoys a much more aggressive form of pricing based upon the risk-free rate and the risk-driven rate. Now, the industry structure. Here's where it all starts to come together. Presently, the mortgage industry volume is low and mostly refinanced. In this market, over 90% of all loans are government guaranteed, with the FHA funding about 30%, and up from 7% a few years ago, and Fannie and Freddie funding approximately 60%. The non-conforming portion, the non-government guaranteed portion, makes up very little of today's volume. So, future rates. When you're looking at future rates, one of the things you have to ask is what will be the volume of non-conforming loans going forward? Because as the volume of non-conforming loans increases and becomes a larger portion of the overall mortgage volume, the riskiness of the pool will go up, and therefore the coupon rates, the yield, and the interest rates of those, the overall pool will have to go up in correspondingly, with the majority of the rate increase most likely being on the non-conforming loans. So anyway, that's some groundwork. What's the next question?
So you talk a lot about, well, one clarifying point is, as the non-conforming world rebounds and starts to come up and there's demand, you know, we'll see interest rates increase, but that necessarily won't impact what you're calling the risk-free rate, will it?
No.
Okay. So
no.
It's really the combination of the risk and the risk-driven, I'm sorry, the interest-driven fee rate that's going to increase.
Right,
for the non-conforming, basically. So
right,
you talk a lot
saying about.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh,
go ahead.
You talk
go
a
ahead.
Lot about measuring risk, or how do you identify and measure the risk? Is that basically underwriting guidelines?
Yeah, it's not quite that simple. Let me get into that first. Let's draw a distinction between the risk-free rate, which is determined largely by a process independent of the mortgage origination process, and that's the risk-free rates determined by the capital markets, as we talked about, whereas the risk-driven rate is very intimately related to the manufacturing process, underwriting standards, credit policies, and the like. So let's talk about, on the risk-driven side, the three components of that risk and how we measure those. One risk is credit risk, and as I mentioned, that's the risk of loss and default. There's interest rate risk, and this refers to the risk of prepayment, meaning the borrower prepays the loan before its term ends. And then there's something called manufacturing risk. And this is a new form of risk that has emerged as a significant player. When manufacturing risk is present, the data surrounding and defining the loan has been corrupted. The loan really isn't as it seems. This causes the analyst to underestimate the risk of default, for example, which leads to the underpricing of risk and the risk of investor disappointment. So those are the components of the risk-driven rate. Now, how do we measure these risks? Well,
Can I interrupt you one second? Can you just run through? I know my listeners will want to get a better understanding of the manufacturing risk. Can you just run through that explanation one more time?
Sure. Manufacturing risk is a form of risk. It's relatively new. It's very formidable. It's the kind of risk that is hidden and not made obvious by any data associated with the loan. The source of manufacturing risk is a weakness in the manufacturing process that introduces weak, corrupt, or misleading information about the loan. Its detection is very difficult, and I'm going to get to this in a second. Its detection is difficult, and let me give you an example of what a loan containing manufacturing risk would look like. Let's say the loan has a property appraised for $350,000, and it's listed as a loan-to-value ratio of 80%. Now, when manufacturing risk is present, what happens is the property really isn't worth $350,000 in the current market. It's worth, say, for example, $275,000. And the LTV really isn't 80% anymore. It's much higher. So when manufacturing risk is present, the analyst proceeds as though he's analyzing a loan with $350,000 worth of collateral at an 80% LTV, when he's actually analyzing a loan with only $275,000 of collateral and a much higher LTV, maybe in excess of 100%. So the analyst is proceeding under a false premise. He underrates the riskiness of the loan, overrates its future cash flow, and therefore the price is off and investor disappointment is likely. So does this make more sense?
Yeah, so I mean, so to a certain extent, the risk associated with the manufactured risk is somewhat manageable by the enterprise's quality control or due diligence process, because really the analyst should know that the property is not worth $350,000, or they're so far up the food chain from a securitization process they don't really have insight into that.
Well, that's a good question. What you're really asking is how reliable are the measures of risk? And let's get into those. Credit risk measures, which include such things as FICO and LTV and rating agency opinions, they're moderately reliable at measuring credit risk. Interest rate risk, its measurement reliability is low. We're really trying to use Fed intentions to judge future interest rates and monetary policy, and that's kind of hard to do. And then manufacturing risk, the measurement capability there is very low. You might say, okay, don't they know what the process is? And here's a key point. When they manufacture a loan, they can check the box that they've done step A, step B, step C, step D, and that's fine. But you don't really know if the content is correct. So, for example, you mentioned, don't they know that appraised property is overappraised at $350,000 and should be $275,000? The answer is they don't know, because there's no tool that tells them that the $375,000 or $350,000 rating for that property contains some degree of manufacturing risk. And therefore, the appraisal's likely been hyped and there may be other problems with the appraisal. So they might know the process they put the loan through, but they don't know they don't have an ability to rate the content or the output of that process with respect to manufacturing risks. So therein lies the dilemma. They can manufacture the loan, and they can double down on the current manufacturing process, which is largely labor-intensive, so they can make sure they checked all the boxes, but they can't really evaluate the content risks. So, for example, is the valuation of the property correct or not, or does it contain some kind of manufacturing defect? Is the income stated by the borrower or used to evaluate the borrower, is that correct or not, or is it somehow or another defective? Is the occupancy intention correct or not? Are the assets and liabilities as stated on the loan origination, are they accurate, or do they contain some kind of defect? So what happens when you go through the mortgage origination process in today's process is that you do check all the boxes, and they're very aggressive now about making sure all the boxes have been checked. But you don't really know if the content, such as income, such as appraised value, and so forth, you don't know if the content is correct or not. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, we know, from an origination perspective, theoretically, right, the operators feel like they know because they're underwriting and they have their hands in the file. But what you're saying, there's a certain level of the ability to measure that risk that is not transparent.
Yeah, and let's go one step further. The originator, which is at the beginning of the food chain, may feel that he's real comfortable with the quality of that loan, or he may know where certain of the quality problems lie, because their objective is really to get the loan sold. It's not necessarily to ensure its quality. So the originator may or may not be entirely comfortable, but he will be comfortable if the loan gets sold. What the problem is that what way do we have to communicate the quality of that loan to the people that are pooling it for securitization in the secondary market and the investor that's actually buying it? There's no way to transfer that originator's feeling or opinion into the securitization process and downstream into the investor's hands. So the investor is presented with a bit of a dilemma. He can get some indication of the credit risk and the risk of prepayment, but he can't get a real good opinion of the likelihood of manufacturing defect. And so without that, he's faced with the following kind of problem. How much should he believe the data he has about the loans that he's about to buy? And therein lies the problem. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So how is the industry perceiving and measuring currently manufacturing risk? I haven't really heard a lot of talk about it, but it seems like something that the industry should be focused on.
Yeah. Well, before we get into manufacturing risk and how that's perceived and so forth, let's talk about a confusion that exists. And there's a confusion between credit risk and manufacturing risk. They're not really the same, but many assume that by decreasing credit risk, such as increasing FICOs and lowering LTVs, that they've also reduced manufacturing risk. Our research at Digital Risk suggests that's quite different. That those two are separate. So there's some deception afoot. It's not intentional, but I think people think that because they've increased the credit quality of loans, they've decreased the manufacturing risk. And our tools are showing that that's not quite the same and not quite the case. For example, the industry, when it measures manufacturing defects today, says it thinks it has a 3-5% serious defect rate. When you take new tools and apply them against the same loans, you find that the rate is somewhere between 8-10% or 2 to 3 times greater. And so this is on a population of high FICO, low LTV, 2011, 2012 loans that are having more manufacturing risk inherent in them than the industry is aware of. So
it's a little bit scary to think that the manufacturing risk is that high in this environment. What was it back in 2006 and 2007? It must have been extremely high, I would imagine.
It was extremely high. Yeah, I don't have a good estimate of that, but if you wanted to think of 1 in 5 loans as having a serious problem, especially during the heydays, it might have been 1 in 4 loans having a serious problem. That you would not be far off. So it has come down. It has come down, and so the industry has made some progress. It's just that I don't think, and our data suggests, that it's not as far along with reducing manufacturing risk as it thinks it is.
Well, I think the industry really has reduced manufacturing risk, really not intentionally, because they're not really understanding it, but just by the tightening up the guidelines. But the methodology of identifying that risk, it still sounds like lack of process or transparency is the same as it was back then.
Yeah, here's the basic issue. The process of manufacturing a loan from an infrastructure standpoint is largely the same. They're taking largely the same industry structure, major money center banks, major correspondent lenders, and so forth, who are manufacturing loans largely with the same loan origination systems, using the same people and the same process as before. They're just doubling down on the amount of labor absorbed by this particular process. But they don't have new tools or a new information infrastructure that helps them gauge each loan with respect to manufacturing risk. So therein lies the problem. The industry needs a new infrastructure with respect to data, analytics, and information at large in order to really get its hands around what the manufacturing risk levels are, how to manage them, how to keep them low, and also to create an index that can go forward to the secondary market so that investors know not only what the credit risk is, but also what the manufacturing risk is on any loan they want to buy.
So why does the industry seem to overlook manufacturing risk?
The long and short story there is that it's a relatively new kind of risk, and you realize the mortgage industry, until the meltdown, especially prior to the year 2000, was probably the most successful lending entity in the world of all time, really. It lent trillions of dollars at a loss rate of 20 basis points. That's unbelievable. And they created an information infrastructure, dubbed the FICO LTV infrastructure, that really managed that lending process and managed that level of risk. Unfortunately, they erroneously concluded that they had a true formula for managing all kinds of risks. So they doubled down, expanded the borrower pool to include subprime and Alt-A, expanded the product pool, relaxed the underwriting standards, and also put a lot of cheap money chasing too few properties, which caused a lot of property appreciation. Now they created a whole new set of risks, and the old information structure really wasn't able to handle it. So finally, through this process of the meltdown and the digging through the rubble, they've discovered this concept of manufacturing risk. Other people call it operations risk. Some people call it fraud. But so that's how they came to miss it, because they had been so successful for so long, they thought they had it. They thought they had it knocked, and they really didn't.
So what tools then are available? I mean, how would someone who's identified that there is manufacturing risk, what's their strategy at this point? I mean, what do they do? What data do they use? What methodologies do they use to gauge and manage that risk?
Well, that's a good question, because the industry really needs a new set of tools. The tools that are in play today were the same tools that were in play before the meltdown, and these are tools that let down the industry. They failed to warn them of the impending problems they were going to have with manufacturing defects in the loans. So the tools today are suspect. They're used, but I don't think people really understand, nor can they apply them and determine what kind of manufacturing risks they're really dealing with. So they really need a new set of tools based upon a new set of data and infrastructure that also relates to something like what we call performance data. For example, at Digital Risk, we have performance data on 750,000 forensically audited loans that identifies the kind of manufacturing defect in the loan and associates those defects with particular patterns in the loan with regard to the type of loan, the type of origination process, the type of borrower, the type of property, the local real estate market, and so forth. So you really need that kind of methodology that's predicated upon vigorous research of past manufacturing defect problems, harvest that and bring it forward to the origination process to begin to have a shot at estimating and communicating manufacturing risk. Does that make sense?
Yes. So, I mean, is there a specific tool out there, or is there a certain recommendation? I mean, you just kind of covered a lot of information. But is there something that's kind of wrapped up and tied in a bow that an investor can utilize?
Sure. There's a product that we at Digital Risk, which we've used by harvesting our performance database. It's called Veritas, and it's a product that basically estimates manufacturing risk and on a loan level, and gives those people who are either buying the loan or reviewing the loan or quality assuring the loan an estimate of the manufacturing risk of each loan, along with descriptions of the kinds of problems that loan may have and what to go do about it. So there is a product. It's new. It's recently developed, but it's there.
And so what's the arbitrage? So if there's you know, I'm an investor and I'm playing in the secondary world, the capital markets world, and I see and I have this tool to go out there and look at data and say I'm looking at a certain securitization and have the ability to go in there and mm-hmm. identify a certain amount of manufacturing risk. What's mm-hmm. the play there from an arbitrage perspective?
Well, I think the play looks something like this. If you identify a pool of loans that has a very low level of manufacturing risk, then you can proceed to evaluate that using your normal methodology. But if you have a pool of loans or a security backed by a pool of loans that has a high level or, you know, higher than expected level of manufacturing risk, now you have to discount the cash flow from those loans, and so therefore you pay less. So, for example, those kinds of loans you either stay away from or you short, and you go long on the ones where you have a low level of manufacturing risk. So if you can determine that, you can pick the loans that will perform as specified from those that will not perform as specified. So that's your arbitrage.
So we are shortly out of time. So kind of rounding back to my very first question, where do you think interest rates, the risk-free rates, as well as the risk-driven rates will head in the next, say, 18, 24 months?
Okay. The risk-free rate, I think the Fed's going to be successful at keeping that rate low. So the 10-year note will probably still be priced around 200 basis points. It's gone up a little, but I see the Fed responding very aggressively to keep that rate low. So the short-term risk-free rate, I think, is going to be fine. The risk-driven rate also, I think that's going to stay relatively low because most of the loans are still going to be government guaranteed, so the risk-driven rate's not going to be that applicable. Only if the industry solves its information infrastructure, manufacturing defect, data transparency problem so that the secondary market is convinced that the manufacturing process is sound, and it knows not only the credit risk but the manufacturing risk, only then will the non-conforming market open up, and only then will you start seeing large volumes of non-conforming loans being sold, and therefore the overall riskiness of the pool will go up, and therefore the interest rates will go up. But I don't see that happening in 18 months. I think it's going to take a little longer.
And are there, as far as you know, you mentioned, I've talked a lot about this, there's going to be a new level of transparency on non-conforming securitized products.
Yes.
You know, in the old day, when I worked at RFC, the master servicer, we'd send them a spreadsheet once a month, and they did whatever they did, and then they would roll it up to the bondholder. But I would imagine the bondholder, the investor at this point, is going to want to drill down all the way at loan level data and look at performance.
Absolutely.
Is that process or that methodology taking hold, and are there people addressing that need for transparency as far as products or technology or methodology today?
Yeah. Let me talk a little bit. The FHFA has mandated some data standards. There's some called the Uniform Loan Data Delivery or ULDD standards that specify a whole portfolio of data that has to accompany each loan. And there's also the UCDP, which stands for data about the collateral or the appraisal, and that's also a standardized set of data that's being generated. Those standards went into effect maybe 6 months ago, and so now the industry is trying to go forward and first figure out how to harvest this data and include it in its securities and then get that out to the investor community. And then another challenge will be, okay, it's a lot of data, and there might be as many as 1,000 fields of data there. So it's kind of like we had no data before, now we've got 1,000 fields per loan. So you can imagine what the problem then becomes is that, okay, what does all this data mean and how do I make sense out of it all? So you're going to have that process you go through, but they are trying to do it. They are being successful, and there are some ULDD and UCDP data tracks that are being presented with loans, and you can start seeing those in certain areas of the industry. Hopefully it'll become industry-wide, but the next step really, assuming the industry does promulgate those kinds of data, is to figure out how to use those data in some form of rigorous credit risk and manufacturing risk evaluation scheme. Make sense?
And that makes sense, and therefore that's why it's not going to happen in the next 2 to 3 years. Right? It's going to take some time for all that to work through. Tom, mm-hmm. I appreciate the time you've taken. The information is extremely valuable in a new way of looking at data. So I thank you for being on the broadcast. hopefully we can have you back on in a few months to get an update on what's happening.
Thank you. Appreciate the time, Lewis.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
That wrapped up today's show. Please connect through Capital Markets Group today on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Tag name Lewis Amaya Cap Markets Today. Today's show and closing riff is sponsored by iServe Lending. We'll talk to you next time.